Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Our Earth is pretty amazing. A Goldilocks of the universe whose not too hot, not too cold conditions allow millions of organisms to survive and thrive. And today, April 22nd, is Earth Day. So we decided to commemorate the day with three guests showcasing how Ohioans protect our land, our air, and our water. First, we're diving into the water with some manatees, specifically the manatees being rehabilitated at the Columbus Zoo. Doug Warmolts is the Columbus Zoo's Vice President of Animal Care, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Doug.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. Happy Earth Day.
Yeah, happy Earth Day. I want to begin by asking you to explain the partnership that you have with the Cincinnati Zoo, Zoo Tampa, and SeaWorld, because it's pretty unusual to have a manatee rehab facility outside of Florida.
Well, it all began back in the mid-90s. Jack Hanna was in Florida filming one of his shows, and it was about releasing a rehabilitated manatee back at Homosassa Springs, which is just north of Tampa. And Jack offered our assistance and came back to the zoo after that visit, and we built Manatee Coast, which we opened in 1999. And then we started in our involvement with the Manatee Rescue and Rehabilitation Partnership. There are 22 facilities that are involved in this, partners, including those that you mentioned. And our role is to take injured or orphan animals up to Ohio. They spend a year or two with us, and then we return them and release them and track them afterwards.
So our zoo here in Columbus is a second stage rehabilitation facility. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. So within our partnership, we have layers. So there is the first layer are the stranding network spotters along the coast. And these can be everyday people that live there that could see an animal in distress, call into a hotline number, and then we have partners that will go out and verify whether or not it's an animal that needs to be rescued. If they do, then they come into critical care facilities within the state of Florida, including SeaWorld, Zoo Tampa, and Jacksonville Zoo, and a couple of others that are coming online. And then those animals are assessed for their injuries. Those that are short-term animals have injuries that can turn around and go back out in a few months, are kept at that facility. Those who require longer term rehabilitation come to the second stage facilities like Columbus and Cincinnati, and they'll spend that time with us. In recent years, most of the animals that are coming up to us are young animals, very young animals, less than a year old. And we have a resident here, her name is Stubby. And she is wonderful. If you haven't been to see her, you need to come. She's a very large surrogate mother. So she adopts these young animals that are coming in from Florida and treats them like they're her mom. And they'll spend that time with her. And there's a normal separation. And then usually around a year and a half, year or 2 years, when they reach a certain size and length, then they're ready to go back. And then we send them back down to Florida, where they're acclimated back to natural foods, and they're fitted with the tracking gear that we put on to the animals and then release them.
In October, you all flew a total of 8 manatees back to Florida in preparation for their release back into the wild. And I have to ask a logistical question here, because manatees can weigh 6,000 pounds or more. So how do you get them on a plane?
We have large, specially constructed boxes that we use for them, and they're lined with foam, and they do fine out of water. We just put them into these boxes. We keep them wet during the transport, and we fly them in planes. We rent space typically on commercial carriers like DHL, who's been a very good partner with us.
The package delivery people.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
DHL is the package delivery people.
Exactly.
So these are just giant packages.
And they've been wonderful, and they are out of Cincinnati, so that is who we've used in recent years. We've also used Federal Express or commercial other private planes, but that was such a big transport, and we did it in conjunction with the Cincinnati Zoo that it was a multiple day, multiple animal transport, biggest one we've ever done.
Yeah, and I understand that three of those manatees, Squirrel, Lizzie, and Mary Kate, are now back in the wild at Blue Springs State Park in Florida. That's got to feel pretty good.
It does. It's rewarding to do this, and it fits our mission, conservation mission, to rescue, rehabilitate, and release these animals. But it comes at a risk because now they're out there and they're facing the threats that manatees face every day. And so we track them for a year. We have tracking gear and we monitor them at a satellite telemetry level to a radio and a sonic transmitter radio. All the partners participate in hiring and paying the salaries for biologists that work for the MRP in the state of Florida to do that tracking for us for a year. So it's a very important step to get those guys back out into the wild.
Is it ever bittersweet? Like, are you and the other zoo employees ever sad to see them go?
Of course, yes. It's whenever you move animals, and it's for all the animals at the zoo. We are regularly moving animals in and out of the zoo to participate in managed breeding programs. But these animals face an additional hurdle because they're going back out into the wild. So there's an unknown there that we track them, we monitor them. We've lost some animals, which is heartbreaking. And we've also had some successes, which is something we celebrate.
We also want to hear from you this hour. Now we're talking about big picture of manatee rehabilitation, but we want to know little steps that maybe you take on a day-to-day basis or how you're planning on celebrating Earth Day. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. So I have to ask, because I can remember hearing about manatee injuries from boats when I was a kid. So why does this continue to be such a problem in Florida?
Well, manatees are in the waterways that people who live in Florida use for recreation. So there are laws in place that minimize that, such as slow wake zones or no wake zones, especially during migratory times of the year. Accidents happen. And then there are natural issues that the animals face as well. In the Indian River Lagoon area in down near Miami, in that area, there's a very important overwintering sites for manatees, and they come into these sites for in the winter time, especially to feed on the vegetation this year. And then we had an unfortunate mass mortality event involving manatees because the grass is being smothered and killed by from fertilizer and other runoff coming from the areas near where people live. It's starting to come back, but the natural events, well, that's not really a natural event, but events like that, red tide events, boat strikes, becoming entangled in fishing gear and both commercial and fishermen. So like us living here in Columbus and learning to live with wildlife, such as white-tailed deer and other animals that have become urbanized and living around us, people in Florida need to learn to do the same thing with manatees.
Yeah, they're very sensitive to cold water, right? So those like winter habitats are super important.
They are. So they're tropical marine mammals. So they don't have a thick blubber layer that
Which,
allows
looking at
them.
them, you would think they would.
Yes. But they're big. I mean, think of them. They're called sea cows, and they just and so they're big ruminants that eat a lot of vegetation. That's why they look so big. But they really are very gentle animals. But they do need to find warm water sites in the wintertime to overwinter. And those are typically springs, such as Blue Springs, that have natural water that comes up at a temperature that's sufficient for them. There are a lot of artificial warm water sites. These are effluents from power plants and things like that that they also rely on in order to overwinter. With I meant, heard earlier you talk we're talking about changes in the climate, and so warmer areas up in the upper Gulf and even up the East Coast are allowing manatees to migrate up into the use those areas. So there are additional challenges that they face in the winter times there. That it's not uncommon now to see manatees moving up into Georgia and the Carolinas, maybe even as far north as Virginia. And those animals need to make their way back down to warmer water in the wintertime.
How significant of a comeback have manatees made since they were listed as an endangered species?
It's a hard question to answer. It really depends. There was a time where it looked like their numbers were increasing, and that may very well may be. It also might be just an artifact. We're better at doing the counts and the census and understanding where manatees are. So there are surveys that usually happen at least every other year by the state to assess that. Then you have a unusual mortality event, as I mentioned, in Indian River Lagoon, or red tide events that'll knock those back. So they're still listed as a protected species, and I anticipate they'll be have that for years to come.
Let's talk a little bit about their importance for the ocean. So, like we've been saying, they're also called sea cows, and I think that's a fair nickname since they eat a lot of sea grass, and that keeps the seabeds from being overgrown. But, what else do they do in their environment that makes them an important member of their ecosystem?
Well, as you mentioned, they are part of that important food web in and around the bays, estuaries, and rivers where they're found. I think an animal species, especially a dangerous species, doesn't always have to have some critical occupy some a critical niche in order for them to be important and valuable to us. They're part of our natural heritage. They've been there for long before we were here, and I think they continue to deserve that. I mean, they're like a priceless piece of art. I mean, if you look at it, it's just pigment on a piece of canvas, right? But it's that value that we put on them that makes them so valuable. Plus, they're so charismatic, and people they're emblematic of when you travel to Florida. I mean, a lot of people that live in this part of the country that go to Florida relate to that animal, and as being an iconic species that you would expect to see. And they're through the whole Caribbean too. So this is a species that is found in multiple areas around the Caribbean and in South America and in Africa.
And how can we here in Columbus help preserve and rehabilitate them?
Well, coming to the zoo, supporting the zoo, obviously. We contribute a significant amount of money annually to the MRP program to support all the work that we're doing. So when you come to the zoo or support the zoo, you are directly helping the manatees. We also, the MRP has a website. If you Google manateerescue.org, you can learn more about who we are and what we do. And we put all the tracking information on that
Oh, so you
website.
can follow them?
You can tr follow
Oh.
them. It's very exciting. So you can go look at, you mentioned squirrel and scampi, and there are others, the Columbus animals that are out there right now. So you can go to the website and track them.
Oh, that's gonna be fun. So if like you've taken your kids and they saw Squirrel and Mary Kate, and now you can be like, hey, that's where they are in Florida right now.
We've Columbus, we've released 30, I think we're up to 37, 38 animals in the time that we've been involved in it. So there's a lot of animals out there.
It's also an objectively like cool enclosure because it's a big glass wall, so you can very easily like see them.
It's a great place to come in the wintertime,
Oh, because it's
especially.
balmy. Yeah.
Yes, because it feels like Florida in there. It is very tropical. It's big and open. We have live mangroves, and we have other non-releasable animals that have been rehabilitated, such as sea turtles and pelicans and other animals that call Manatee Coast their home.
That was Doug Wormald, the Columbus Zoo's Vice President of Animal Care. Thank you so much for your time today.
Happy to.
Coming up, we're analyzing the quality of Central Ohio's air. That's when this Earth Day edition of All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Learn more at nationwidechildrens.org/healthy-kids.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's Earth Day, and we're talking about how Ohioans are protecting our land, water, and air. We just wrapped up our conversation about the Columbus Zoo's manatee rehab program. Now it's time to take a deep breath and talk airborne particles, those teeny tiny pieces of dust, soot, and ash that contribute to what we call particle pollution. It's no joke. The National Weather Service tracks air quality and issues alerts because having too much particulate matter, or PMs, can cause asthma attacks, coughing, even cardiac problems, and sometimes even heart attacks. Which is why we wanted to talk about that study from IQ Air, the one that ranks Columbus as the most polluted major city in the U.S. Here to help us separate air quality fact from fiction is Brandi Whetstone, an associate director of sustainability at the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission. Welcome to All Sides, Brandi.
I really appreciate it. And thank you for giving me the chance to talk about air quality in Central Ohio and to clear the air about misinformation that's floating around about our air quality.
I am for all of the air puns this hour. So by all means, do not hold back. And we also want to hear from you this hour. Tell us about the small or maybe not so small steps you take in your daily life to protect the planet. Give us a call at 614-292-8513. So I think air quality is one of those issues that we forget about until we see it, like literally see it, like the Canadian wildfires that blew smoke down across the Great Lakes last summer. Those days we could look out our windows and see how bad it was.
For sure. That was really an eye-opening experience, I think, for a lot of people in Central Ohio, because over the past 30 years, we've continually been improving air quality when you look at the big picture in the long term. But when we experience something like the wildfire smoke, and it's right there, you can see it, you can smell it. And I think a lot of people had some reactions. You know, it affects people with asthma, with COPD, and other respiratory illnesses. So I think it was really eye-opening for a lot of people who have never experienced that type of pollution.
But most days, it's nowhere near that smoggy outside, thank goodness. Which is why I was surprised to see Columbus rank higher than Los Angeles in that IQ Air study for 2 years in a row. And I'm hoping you can help us understand what's going on here. And I want to break it down into chunks because this is a lot of science. So first things first, the study says Columbus has the highest concentration of the worst kinds of air pollutants, what they call PM2.5. So what are PM2.5 and why are they so dangerous to humans?
Well, that's a great question. I know that this is jargon, but it really means particulate matter pollution. It comes from activities such as burning. Obviously, with wildfires, they create a lot of particulate matter pollution. Our vehicles, industry, and other types of burning activities and construction activities where there's a lot of fine dust in the air. And I think you said it well in the introduction. There's a lot of health complications that can come from breathing this type of pollution in the long term. It can cause and, really exacerbate asthma symptoms, just generally shortness of breath. It can also affect folks that have heart disease. These tiny particles are 30 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. And
So
so they
very
can
tiny.
easily, very tiny, they can easily get into the lungs and the bloodstream. So it's something to pay attention to. And particle pollution is also regulated because of its impact on public health. So at MORPC, we monitor for ozone and particle pollution or PM2.5.
So that leads actually into my next question, which is how do we measure how many of these tiny particles are in the air at any given time?
Well, not to get too far into the weeds, but it's a measurement that, how do I describe
Well,
it?
there's sensors, right, that
Yes, you're right. We use officially in the region, Ohio EPA operates highly precise monitors, and those monitors collect this information to determine if we're meeting the federal air quality standards. So they have to meet very high standards for this data. We also collect this data using low-cost air sensors, which are available to the public now. And you can buy one, let's say, for example, Purple Air, which is what MORPC and Franklin County Public Health have been using in the field. You can purchase one for around $250 to $300. Now, with these sensors, they're really great for creating more data where you have lacking information in certain communities, but they don't meet the same level of quality as these regulatory monitors operated by Ohio EPA.
and this is where the IQ Air readings come in, because the kinds of sensors that they use for their assessments give you a little bit of pause, right?
Well, I can say that it is somewhat difficult to comment on the report since we don't have access to IQ Air's detailed data collection and methods.
That's something they
But
haven't
based,
shared.
right, they've shared a little bit, but some of it is also proprietary. And based on what little we do know, it seems that their approach could really have an inaccurate representation of air quality in central Ohio. And I can explain that a little bit more here. For one, they aggregate the pollution data from a combination of our regulatory monitors that I explained. They meet very high standards. And they also combine that data with that of the low-cost sensors that are available for general use. And with that, it's definitely an inappropriate blending of data that can lead to inaccurate pollution numbers.
Now, I will say that IQ Air has previously defended their network of sensors to WOSU, saying that the company argues they get a better picture because they have many more monitors in place than the Ohio EPA. And I'm not going to ask you to litigate who is better, but I do want to make that clear. But interestingly, Columbus didn't even rank in the American Lung Association's State of the Air report for 2023. So IQ Air has us as the worst, but we don't even register with the American Lung Association.
That's correct. And MORPC puts out an annual air quality report as well, using the data from the EPA's regulatory monitors. And that local pollution data doesn't support the claims made by IQ Air in their report. Based on an assessment of regulatory monitors across the country, even the highest monitor reading in Columbus for PM2.5 is the 149th highest ranking in the US. So think about that, a lot of other metro areas, including others in Ohio, like Cleveland and Cincinnati, all have higher readings than Columbus's highest reading, which is definitely one way to confirm Columbus is nowhere near the most polluted major city in the U.S. And the Columbus region is also meeting the federal air quality standards for PM2.5. We're also meeting standards for ozone pollution. So I think there's a lot of data showing otherwise that this information doesn't represent the Columbus region.
I'm hoping you can tell me a little bit about your partnership with Franklin County Public Health to create an air quality monitoring network.
Sure, I would love to. A few years back, MORPC joined up with Franklin County Public Health to start to try to understand and get a better picture of what local air quality looks like at very specific sites and neighborhoods. And the idea was really to compare this data between those sites with each other and with our EPA's regulatory monitors, and to identify if there's certain locations that show trends for higher pollution levels, especially looking at those communities that are disadvantaged and more vulnerable to the effects of air pollution. So if you think about it, across the board, you see trends when you're looking at areas with higher poverty rates, areas with higher asthma rates, more of the African-American communities as well. And this is a pattern you see across multiple indicators. So that's what we wanted to explore. With additional funding, we're able to expand on this work and use a lot of lessons learned to help shape a more robust study, because we've learned using these low-cost sensors that we need to monitor them very closely, as well as make adjustments where there's some unusual readings. So there's just a, you know, there's a lot of variation across the locations and how you cite them that could bias those results. So if you're looking to cite an air sensor in a location where you know or suspect that there's high levels of pollution from a particular source, let's say it's a place where there's always running vehicles emitting pollution, then that may be valuable information for you at that location and for the community to be aware of, but it doesn't mean that it represents the entire community or the entire city.
So that kind of dives into this question that I have about why data by neighborhood might be really important to the residents of Columbus. It sounds like it's because it could, like, air quality could be great downtown, but real bad in this other location.
That's right. There could be some variation. There's a lot of things that influence air pollution levels. Obviously, certain sources that are in the area, if there's industry, if there's much heavier traffic or diesel trucks operating there, for example. But also the weather and wind patterns affect pollution patterns as well. So
yeah, like we saw with the wildfires.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Air pollution doesn't know any political boundaries, right? So wherever the wind carries it is where it's going. And there's a variety of factors with meteorology that impact the pollution levels and whether they're concentrated in one area for a while. If you don't have any air moving and the air is stagnant, then pollutants end up, you know, getting trapped there for a while. Or if you have higher winds carrying the pollutants, often we'll see when we're monitoring pollution, when we put out our air quality forecasts, you'll see with that air quality forecast, a weather related forecast that impacts what we'll see for pollution levels the next day.
Yeah, and your organization, MORPC, as the acronym is called, will actually set up text alerts for you on bad air quality days, right? Which I find, like, really easy, right? Like, I can just get a text alert and be like, oh, okay.
That's right. It's really easy to get the information. So we're part of a network across the country that issues daily air quality forecasts, as I mentioned, and air quality alerts for ozone and particle pollution. When pollution levels are forecasted to reach above 100 on the air quality index, An air quality alert is issued. That means it's unhealthy for sensitive groups. And we typically do that the day ahead so that the public can take actions to reduce their exposure and take actions to reduce their impact on pollution levels. And so you can get alerts by signing up on our website at mortsi.org. You can get them by email, by text. We also have a really great network of partners that put out this information. So you might be driving along the freeway and see something on the highway signs. That's because ODOT put that alert out there. You might also see it, as you mentioned, through the National Weather Service. We have a partnership with the Wilmington office to put out air quality alerts as they're issued in Central Ohio. And other agencies across the state also have partnerships with the National Weather Service. And we also work with Franklin County Emergency Management to put out these alerts.
Yeah, so if you have a child with asthma or a family member with COPD, just get signed up for the text messages. It's like really simple. And then you'll just know a day ahead, oh, maybe keep the kid indoors.
Right. There's certainly ways that you can protect your health and protect the health of your loved ones. If you know this is coming, especially if you're part of those sensitive groups. And like you mentioned, young children are considered sensitive groups, as well as older adults, outdoor workers, because of the level of exposure outdoors. And of course, folks with asthma, lung disease, can really be sensitive to pollution levels, and it can really have a detrimental effect on your quality of life. So it is really important to get this information out there.
So what can we do here, maybe in our own homes, to help reduce the amount of air pollution that's out there?
You know what? There's so many things that you can do. And acknowledging that today is Earth Day, I do want to challenge everyone to pick something that you can do. And if you can do one thing, you can probably do two, three, or four things and commit to that. Keep doing it. Don't just do it today. For starters, because our vehicles create a lot of the air pollution in the region, you can start by exploring your commuting options. MORCSI has a program called GoHio Commute, and we can help the public move toward more sustainable transportation choices, whether that's taking the bus, carpooling with a neighbor or a friend, biking or walking to work. Any of those really have an impact, especially if you keep up that commitment in the long term.
Yeah, those are all great options. And I also understand that if you want to put a sensor up at your business or your home and you're in those certain zip codes, they can also get in contact with you, right?
For sure. We're working with a project advisory committee to prioritize, I think, the areas that are most vulnerable to the effects of pollution. But that leaves a huge space open for where we're going to be siting these air sensors. So if you have a concern in your neighborhood, if you want to be part of that process, please reach out to MORPSI, and we're happy to talk to you.
And that's MORPC.org, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
I know.
Right.
I keep saying MORPSI.
Acronyms.
It's MORPC, and it stands for the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission. I know. We keep saying MORPSI, and I realize that probably a lot of people are like, "What more? What? Or how do we spell that?" Well, Brandy, I want to say thank you so much. Brandy Whetstone is the Associate Director of Sustainability at the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking preservation of our parks and forests and what we can do to protect them. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from the COSI Science Festival. On May 1st, the largest STEM event in Ohio begins. The Big Science Celebration surrounds the COSI building with incredible hands-on STEM activities on May 4th for people of all ages to enjoy. Complete schedule is online at cosiscifest.org.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's Earth Day, and we're talking about how Ohioans are protecting our air, our water, and our land. Our last segment was about Columbus's air quality, and earlier we talked about how Central Ohio is helping rehabilitate manatees, which means it's time to talk about the land. And that means our parks and forests and what we can all do to preserve them. Joining me is Carol Kaufman, Executive Director for the Ohio Environmental Council. Welcome to All Sides, Carol.
Nice to be here, Anna. Thank you.
And before we hop into it, I actually want to read a quick listener email from Donna Nesbitt, who says on Saturday, a group of students and volunteers planted 200 trees in the newly restored wetland at Shepherd's Corner Ecology Center down in Blacklick. And she says wetland restoration is an important part of replenishing groundwater, sequestering carbon, and providing wildlife habitat. That sounds really awesome. So good job, Donna.
Absolutely.
So we've spoken about air and water quality already on the show today. What role does our land and our forests in particular play in contributing to public health and climate change?
Well, so much of a role. You know, Anna, I'm so pleased that I get to talk with you about public lands today. It's one of my favorite topics. And I'll just start by saying, you know, how important parks and public lands have been in my own life. I'm a native of Central Ohio. I grew up, my dad was a plant scientist, and he would take us to places like Battelle Darby Metro Park or Yellow Springs, John Bryan State Park. And he would walk me through the woods and point out all of the varieties of trees and wildlife that we were seeing. And I don't know if I fully appreciated it at the time as a kid, but now I really do understand, you know, just how important it is to connect with our public lands, to appreciate them and understand all the ways that they're vital, not only for doing the work of, you know, filtering water and providing habitat for songbirds and butterflies and chipmunks, but also trapping carbon and cleaning the air, as we know that air quality is a very important thing for us all as well. So many ways that public lands are important. And not only those state parks like Hocking Hills or John Bryan, but also our metro parks. I love to get out in our metro parks and even those little parks down the street where our kids like to go and play.
Yeah, they're also just a great place to relax and run and hang out. And like you said, I think a lot of people, especially during the pandemic, rediscovered like a love of their local parks.
They sure did. It was crowded on the trails at the metro parks during the pandemic. That was pretty great.
And by the way, if you want to share the little things that you're doing to make your life a little more sustainable, or like Donna, if you did something particularly for Earth Day, you can also email us at allsides@wosu or call 614-292-8513. And we got an email from Richard Jones, who says he reuses his plastic sandwich bags over and over again. And one from Shannon Flanders, which says she's honoring Earth Day by making sure folks all over the state know about what's happening at the Ohio Oil and Gas Land Management Commission. Is that something that you can walk us through, Carol?
The Ohio Oil and Gas Land Management Commission is very important to the protection of our state parks, and I'm glad to hear that people are aware of that. Well, we can't really talk about state lands and protecting them without talking about fracking. And, you know, as your listeners well know, fracking is a part of our state's economy. And last year, the legislature passed some laws to open up the state lands and state parks to fracking near them and underneath state lands. So that is something that our organization, the Ohio Environmental Council, has been engaged in trying to hold the legislature and state government accountable and really try to protect these lands. You know, we are only 30% forested, and that's down from originally 95% of the state, if you can imagine that being natural forest land. And we are, as Ohio, near the bottom of the 50 states for the number of public acres that have been preserved per person. So we have a lot of work to do just to preserve the lands we already have, let alone expanding access and expanding those lands.
Yeah, if anybody ever wants a really interesting read, actually, on what Ohio looked like when it was first being explored. There's a great book called The Pioneers. And when they talk about the sycamores being so large that they're touching across either side of the river, I'm like, where are those trees? And they talk about all the wild animals that they encounter and all of this. It's such a totally different landscape in those books.
It's true. And I think the best thing we can do is at least get out to where there are mature forests and really begin to appreciate those big trees. I follow a Facebook group called Big Trees Ohio, and there really are big trees all around us if we can just look out for them. But I think, you know, your point really is important, that when people can appreciate, when we can connect with nature and the lands and the parks around us, then we can begin to appreciate them. And that's when we really get excited. You know, you work to protect something that you love and appreciate. So, you know, if people hear nothing else today, I hope that they hear this is your hall pass to go and enjoy nature and connect with your local park today on Earth Day.
And what are some ways, like large and small, that we can help protect our parks for the future?
Yeah. Well, certainly you can support your parks, get out in them, as I was saying, you know, take your friends, your family, your neighbors, your kids, and really, you know, do appreciate and use those parks. I appreciate how our local metro parks, when I go out in them, I'll see signs that say, you know, this trail restoration or this meadow was funded by the park levy. Thank you for supporting your local parks. So we can all do that. We can all continue to support our local parks. And call for more land to be set aside. You know, if we are the seventh highest population state, but near the bottom in terms of public acres available, you know, that means that Ohioans can reach out to our lawmakers, to our state leaders, and really strongly encourage them to preserve more land. And one good example that we have seen in the last year in Central Ohio is a new state nature preserve at the Little Darby Creek on the western side of the region. So I just wanted to give a moment of a shout out to ODNR for continuing to, you know, restore wetlands and increase the number of acres under preservation as well.
And what about in our own backyards?
In our own backyards, now you're getting into things like if you've got access to green space in your own home, you can do things like plant native plants. And they always say, you know, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time is today. My dad was a big planter of trees, and I really learned from that legacy. You know, many of the trees he planted when I was a child are growing and flourishing and, you know, 50 feet tall today. So that tells you how old I am. But certainly we can all do that. We can be planting trees. We can be planting plants in whatever green space we have available to us.
Yeah, we collected all the acorns that fell last fall and sort of tossed them into this little wooded area behind our house. And I don't know, I think maybe we just fed the squirrels, but we'll see what happens.
That's great. I love to hear that. That's really fun.
And, you know, the Columbus Metro Parks also have a lot of programs, which are really interesting. Everything from like snowshoeing to rock climbing or to like night hikes. They have all this like great seasonal activity that you wouldn't normally think of.
They do. They have wildflower hikes. They have a winter hike series. So, you know, you can get out year round and really enjoy the parks and the nature that is available to you. And our household certainly does that, not just during the pandemic, but today as well.
I also want to talk a little bit about some of our national forests. So in particular, the Wayne National Forest, it's about 40,000 acres. So it's big, but there's also federal conversation around leasing that property out for fracking again.
That is correct. So a couple of years ago, the Ohio Environmental Council's Law Center successfully litigated to stop the Sunny Oaks clear cutting project that was undertaken by the U.S. Forest Service. So that was recently decided in our favor to halt the clear cutting of these white oaks. As we learn more about forests and how all of the pieces and parts work together in the ecosystem, we've learned that you can't just cut down a species like the white oak and think that everything around it will continue to thrive. So you mentioned the squirrels that love acorns, they depend on the oaks and all of these other species, all of the fungal networks in that environment really depend on it being intact. And so we were really excited last year to see a win in that case to protect thousands of acres in the Wayne. But as you just mentioned, there are new threats that we have to continue to address. And we are prepared, with some of our partners to continue to bring legal action when necessary to protect. It is our only national forest in Ohio, and it's a gem. It is in the Hocking Hills region of the state where many people from central Ohio like to go and get away and connect with nature. And so we think it's worth fighting for.
Yeah, and I don't think sometimes people realize that national parks have totally different protections from national forests.
That's right. Yeah, the legal background, the legal framework for guiding how these lands are used and protected is really complicated. And we do, I know Nathan Johnson, our senior attorney for Lands and Water, was on your show a few weeks ago talking about the litigation that he has led. He's become a deep expert on all of the legal provisions and protections for these different lands in the state, with the goal, that we could see better protected and connected corridors. So it's not enough that you have maybe one park over here and then there's a separation. Wildlife doesn't look at a map and decide, well, now I'm crossing the boundary into a state forest instead of a national park, right? So we have to think about how do we build connected corridors in order for nature to have a chance to flourish.
I want to take a quick call from Barbara in Dublin. Barbara, tell me about your backyard.
Hi, yes, I am a corner lot in a neighborhood here in the suburbs of Dublin, and for years I was doing the weed and feed and trying to get my grass to be green and lush to no avail. By July, it was dry, hot, and it just ended up not ever working. The weeds came anyway. So a few years ago, I decided I'm done with that. I dug up about 75% of my lawn, and my neighbors thought I was crazy, but I went back with things that are native to Ohio, like ground covers and evergreens and creeping thyme. And now I have so many compliments, and it does so much better than my lawn ever did. But I told my neighbors I'm giving my suburban lawn back to nature. And I also did the area between the sidewalk and the street because of the Columbus Blueprint program that I learned about the runoff. And I've got all kinds of ground covers there as well, and it's been doing really well, much better than my lawn ever did.
Oh, that's awesome. Thanks for sharing, Barbara.
Thank you. I love the show.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that depends whether your HOA will allow that kind of thing or not. But if they do, particularly in your backyard, it is, I mean, you also get out of mowing.
That's true. And who likes to mow? And you can also, depending where you live, which city you're in, you can also talk to your city council members and ask them to introduce an ordinance that would allow you to do things like plant native flowers in your tree lawn or, turn part of your front yard into a garden. So you can also advocate at the very local level to do more to protect nature in your own yard. It's a
Yeah,
great story.
there are some Western states in particular that like will pass laws against banning of xeriscaping in particular.
Yes, and I don't know if everybody knows what xeriscaping is, but I'm just excited that you brought it up. Yeah, it's a great example of, using plants that are native to your environment that don't need a lot of water. And that's another thing, if you can find native plants to Ohio, they're probably going to need less upkeep, as your caller noted. They don't need as much fertilizer, they don't need as much water. They're just going to thrive in the environment that you have.
You just have to figure out how to save them from the bunnies.
Or allow the bunnies to take their cut. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. We're getting down to the last couple of minutes. Do you have any final suggestions or recommendations for listeners or how they can find you guys?
Sure. Well, there's lots you can do. And I think, like I said, my first suggestion would be that you just spend time connecting with, learning about the parks that you have available to you. And then you can also check out the OEC's website. It's theoec.org. We've got lots of Earth Day content live today. You can take action. You could sign comments to the Bureau of Land Management if you're interested in protecting the Wayne National Forest, as Anna mentioned. They are accepting public comments as they're deciding whether they want to go forward with another logging project in the forest. And you can also find lots of other places to give back and make your voice heard and protect our public lands.
And to circle back to our first segment on manatees, we got an email from Brenda that says the post office has manatee stamps, which is also really fun. So I want to say thank you to Carol Kaufman, the executive director for the Ohio Environmental Council. Thank you so much for joining us on Earth Day.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. But before we go, I do want to quickly point out that Maggie says that she and her mate have planted 1,700 native trees on their 21-acre farm. Congratulations, Maggie. That's a lot of digging. And that'll do it for All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.